Today's podcast, we will be talking about a study that was funded by the Department of Homeland Security Science and Technology Directorate Detection Canine Program. This podcast presents the positions of the researchers and not necessarily that of the Department of Homeland Security.
Welcome, everyone, to the JSW Canine Podcast. Today, we have an array of special guests with us today. We have Sarah Kane from Texas Tech University, Bart Rogers from Auburn University, Jennifer Davis Miller from Auburn University, and Lucia Lazarowski from Auburn University. Will you guys, in that order, give us a brief introduction about yourselves?
Yeah. Hi, I am Sarah. I am a PhD student at Texas Tech University studying specifically canine generalization.
And Bart.
So at Auburn, I oversee the selection and development and evaluation of dogs when they're born up to the point that we're training on their first odors, explosive odors, and foundationally preparing them to go to the field to work.
Thank you. Jennifer.
Hi, I'm Jennifer Davis Miller. I'm a canine instructor for Canine Performance Sciences at Auburn University.
Lucia.
Hello, I'm Lucia. I am a research scientist at Auburn, and I am a co-investigator on this project.
Awesome. Well, thanks, guys. It's fun to actually kind of all get together in one little space here to talk about this project. So what are we actually talking about? We recently wrapped up about a year and a half long study that ended up taking us, I think, all together, where we took a whole bunch of dogs and asked a simple question of, you know, what are the best ways to imprint dogs or do that initial odor training to a variety of different kinds of odors? Do you, if you have, say, 6 or 7 or 8, in our case, different odors that you want to train the dogs to, do you mix some together and present the dogs as a single mixed odor? Do you train all the dogs on one odor, then move on to the next odor? Or do you train it where you sort of throw all the different odors at them at one time and let them learn them, not in a mixture, but that each trial or each sort of set of odors that you're training up gets varied essentially from day to day? Does one work faster than another? Is one a bit more efficient than the other? Does one lead to better generalization? In other words, are the dogs better able to generalize to different variants? So say, for example, you train to one explosive. Does that lead to better generalization to variants of that explosive than the other? And that was basically the questions that we had in this project. Lucia, you were sort of running the project as sort of the co-director on the Auburn side of this. Can you give us a little bit of why did we do this study and why was it important?
Sure. So detection dogs have to learn a pretty long list of odors before they can become certified and go work in the field. And that training can take a long time. Time is money. So a lot of explosives are part of the same chemical class as others and share characteristics. And so if we can train dogs on just a few examples from a class and then they can generalize to others from that class without explicit training, that would save us a lot of time. Also, it's highly likely that the dogs are encountering targets in the field that are very different than the ones that they saw in training. So they can smell different depending on the manufacturer or the specific ingredients or other factors. And unfortunately, dogs tend to be very specific and they don't always generalize. And so if we can find ways to help facilitate that, that would be very important for making training more efficient and also making them better performers in the field.
Yeah, that's great. And I mean, and you guys have had done research previously, and I think we even had it in some of our podcasts before about generalization failures with ammonium nitrate varieties. And what were some of the others that you did on that as well?
Yeah, so we've looked at dogs generalizing from ammonium nitrate to different varieties of it. We've looked at potassium chlorate and different sort of ingredients that are used in homemade explosives and how that can change what the odor smells like. So some odors that are mixed with something else to make it an explosive, you know, depending on who's making it and where they are and what ingredients they have available to them, and that can change the profile of the explosive. And so we've looked at if dogs are trained on one specific example or variant, then how do they respond to when it's changed a little bit or a lot and kind of the gradient of what that looks like. For the most part, we find that unless you do specific things in training to give them experience, they are very specific to what they know. which is not surprising because dogs, you know, have really good noses, and it's probably because they any slight change they're going to pick up on and detect. But that can be challenging when, you know, you can't train them to everything that they're ever going to encounter because you never know what they're going to encounter. And so finding ways to help bridge that is really important.
Yeah, exactly. So definitely getting that good generalization can potentially have not just even on training efficiency, but a lot of sort of consequential impacts. So this project, how do we actually do it? Sarah, you were sort of one of the people doing the day-to-day testing. What did it actually look like? How many dogs did we have?
So we began with two different groups of dogs. We had dogs from Auburn's Canine Science Program, and then we had dogs from Texas Tech's Shelter to Adopt Program. Both sets of dogs were completely green on the odors that they were being tested on in this experiment, but they did have varying odor experiences outside of the study. So the Texas group was, for our knowledge, totally green to any odor detection work, and some of Auburn's dogs had some previous experience on odor detection tasks. Again, not with these odors. And so we worked these dogs in different cohorts, and we ran four cohorts through these experiments, and we did one experiment where we looked at generalization to a series of odors that were within the same class, so smokeless powders. We looked at dogs' ability to learn and then also generalize to novel types of smokeless powders within the same class. And then we also looked at between classes. So we had explosives from ammonium nitrate-based, PETN-based plastics, as well as TNT-based explosives. And so then we looked at the acquisition rate, so the how fast a dog learned an odor, and also their ability after these different trainings to generalize to novel targets. Because again, generalization is a critical skill for a lot of these dogs in the field.
So probably the first question people want to know is, was one faster than another?
Yeah. So first looking at the between classes of explosive experiment, we did find that the intermixed group, so the group that learned odors, they would learn four odors at a time, but they would not mix the odor headspaces. Each odor was presented discreetly and trained discreetly, but they would learn four within one training period. Those dogs were slightly, although not significantly, faster to learn the targets that we were asking them to learn compared to a mixture group. And in the mixture group, those dogs were trained to the headspace or the mixed odor headspace of four different explosives. And they were slightly faster, but not significantly so, than a group of sequential dogs, which were trained in the method of learning one target at a time. And then once you acquired that target, moving on to the next, which is how a lot of dogs in the field are trained today to detect different targets is one of the. And so we found that the intermixed method did lead to slightly faster acquisition rates, but not significantly so.
So then for the mixture group, though, you had four different odors being mixed together and you trained them to that. And then you tested each of those, you sort of pulled it out and tested whether they responded to each of those individual odors. What were those four odors and what were the dog's responses to that?
So we had a variant from each class that I mentioned earlier. So that was plastic explosive, ammonium nitrate, PETN-based, and then TNT-based explosives. And so we had a mix of the headspaces of four variants of each of those classes of explosives. And we found largely that dogs that were trained to that odor headspace mixture largely just responded to our plastic-based explosives. So for this, it was C4. We saw pretty strong generalization to that from just learning the mixture, but we saw relatively low rates of a generalization to PETN-based ammonium nitrate and TNT-based explosives within that group.
So how many dogs spontaneously hit to the TNT, just out of curiosity, in that mixture?
No dogs spontaneously hit to the TNT to meet criterion on TNT, meaning all dogs had to be explicitly trained to search for TNT. They couldn't go from the mixture to automatically hitting on TNT.
But what about smokeless powders? Because in the smokeless powders, you have four different like varieties, right? Single bases and double bases of smokeless powders mixed together. How many did they generalize from that mixture?
So yes, yeah, so to go back a second, for our within classes of explosives, we looked at smokeless powders and we saw that acquisition rates actually didn't change between any of the groups. All dogs, regardless if they were trained in an intermixed fashion, which is again, presenting odors discreetly, mixture or sequential, those dogs all learned those initial targets roughly in the same amount of time not significantly differently. The dogs in the mixture group, they were able to generalize to three of the four components of their mixture target, which did facilitate strong acquisition. So they could learn three out of the four relatively quickly. However, that didn't actually lead to faster training overall the whole period. It just led to a jump initially. And then they still had to learn the odor that they failed to generalize to initially.
So overall, it's a zero-sum game, basically, right, in terms of learning time is kind of all worked out the same.
Yes.
And what about generalization? Did one group tend to generalize better than another?
Yeah. This is actually where we started to see some results for the different training paradigms. We did see that the dogs that were trained in an intermixed fashion, and this depended a bit on the odor class that we were looking at. So for our TNT-based explosives, our intermixed dogs actually did have a 72% hit rate on TNT variants that they had never seen before in training. And that compares to a 25% and a 28% between the mixture and the sequential groups. So we did see an operationally relevant hit rate advance for our intermixed dogs compared to our mixture and our sequential dogs just for that class of explosives. We did see significant results for generalization or higher hit rates for plastics and PETN based as well. However, these results were less operationally relevant. So we saw that intermixed dogs had a 19% hit rate for some plastic-based explosives compared to a 3% and 6% for the sequential and mixture. So operationally, that may not be useful for handlers in the field, but for TNT-based explosives, we did see that generalization rates were better after intermixed training.
Could you see like more of a change of behavior for the dogs that were intermixed versus the others?
So if we looked at sniff rate, so that's the amount of time a dog spent sniffing the odor, we did see that there were changes in behavior for the intermixed group compared to the other two, the mixture and the sequential groups as well.
Okay. So even though they may not have had as high of a hit rate, there was still at least some change that maybe might make it easier for training, but it suggests that you can't just intermix and then get spontaneous generalization to everything.
Yes.
You still have to train to a lot of those variants to actually get what you want. So it's something that helps, but is not the, the secret sauce, I guess, if you will, the thing that just kind of...
It's not a magic bullet. Yeah.
Exactly. Okay. Cool. Is there anything else you had in there?
Yeah, so this actually goes to Lucia's point earlier that we also were able to look at if different volatiles in the headspace of explosives helped explain some of these generalization results we are seeing for the dogs. And for both experiments, that within class and that between class, interestingly, what we found is that odors that were unique to certain odors or certain explosives that we were using actually made dogs less likely to generalize to those odors. So it wasn't about commonality, but it was about what made things distinct that could drive that generalization. So for example, if you had a contaminant in one of your odors, the dogs are less likely to generalize to that compared to even if it has a lot of the commonalities of other types of explosives that they may have been trained to, that contaminant may actually drive their lack of generalization.
Oh, that's interesting. So I always like to equate things all back to foods, to bring scents and taste back to food. And pasta sauce is always a good one because everyone's got their own kind of pasta sauce with different ingredients. But if you take your pasta sauce and add cinnamon to it, it's no longer a pasta sauce to me, even if they both have tomato in it. If you have cinnamon in one of them and add it in, it's still a different, it's not the same thing. I wouldn't classify it as pasta sauce anymore or something different.
It's chili now.
Exactly. Yeah. Now it's completely different. That's actually really good because ground beef and everything could be the same. Difference between chili and pasta sauce. Yeah. That's a really good point, Lucia. All right. Well, awesome. We were also, as part of this, really lucky that we had, a researcher's perspective, but also some, highly skilled expertise from actually working with operational dogs and experienced handlers working with us from the Auburn Canine Performance Center, a science center side. So the Auburn trainers took this intermixed method and have been working on sort of trying it outside of the lab or taking it out of the box, if you will. So what does this actually look like in terms of putting it into practice using sort of it as a real world imprinting method?
Well, when we put this into practice, we chose four target odors as our base, similar to the experiment. We imprinted each of those odors individually within a training session of 10 trials, assisting the dogs train final response for the first few trials, and then allowing the dog to work a little more independently, still assisting if needed. With the intermixed method, you'll start layering odors before the dog reaches proficiency on any one target. So during the initial imprinting, the handler should be able to see a noticeable change of behavior or an independent train final response from the dog before moving on to the next odor. Once it's clear that the dog is recognizing odor, you'll layer in the next odor. And once the second odor is imprinted, you can start using both of those odors as targets within a training session, alternating between the two. Likewise, after we imprinted the third odor, we alternated between all three of the targets and so on until all four odors had been imprinted and alternated in training.
So how did it work out? Did you like it?
It was great.
Yeah. Yeah. How did you think that that compares to, you know, what you might have done previously or in other methods?
Well, and you know, traditionally and how I've done it, you know, for years, you know, up until this point, and some other previous things that did it unintentionally. I didn't know I was doing intermixed training when I did it. But, you know, roughly been involved in somewhere around 500-600 dogs imprinted on multiple odors. And typically the way we do is you reach full proficiency, right? So we're working, we're starting with an odor, their first odor, second odor. You would work the dog until like, okay, let's run criteria on this dog. He has to do 20 unassisted trials, right? No falses, no misses, change of behavior, full final response, right? And then what you would do would go, because of spending so much time, in sequentially training it would be the more sequential method, is then we've got to worry about transfer of context. So once the dog meets criteria, reaches proficiency on the odor, then we would take that typically to an intermediate step, some other type of box that's not a box lineup of imprinting, and work there, and then move from that and then to some elementary level operational search set scenario, and then we would probably take it to different operational search scenarios, three or four different types of operational venues, and then come back and layer your next odor, right? Mm-hmm. So, you mean you take that in consideration of, by the time I'm getting on, you know, some places may have required 11, 12 odors, some 8, some, you know, typically around 8, you've repeated that process. You know, it may get quicker, but you're by the time you're on that 8th odor, you may be having to cycle through. Not only is it hitting this odor, now I have to have a scenario where I layer in the odors that I already know in a cert, right?
Yep.
That learned previously. So the difference would be that we're training 4 odors, right? We're not spending all the time in meeting this level of proficiency before we shift to the other one. And instead of a matter of, say, 2 to 3 weeks to layer 4 odors, we now have 4 odors, and what would you say, Jennifer? We were easily with a quality dog, 2 days, 2 to 3 days.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
And that was only running 2 short sessions a day with each dog.
Yeah. So being able to, and that's with, you know, testing whether they, you know, running a baseline test to actually know that they know the odors once we finish the 4 odors, right? So actually checking that. At the end. So not only was it, you know, how much time and efficiency you got from that logistical, you know, issues with sequential, the way I've always done it, you know, we're down 2 or 3 days. I've got 4 odors.
This sounds like one of those really weird situations where, like, things work better outside of the lab than in the lab, where, like, we found something that seems to work. And then usually when you bring it out to the field and test it, it all falls apart and disintegrates. But it sounds like it's actually getting better with time rather than worse.
Well, I mean, I think that's always the fight between the trainer and the scientist is, you know, we have to control so many variables to say for certain what the data means and, you know, the integrity of the data. When we loosen this up, now that we know from the data into a practical aspect, you know, practical type scenario, we're able to move a lot faster. I think, you know, I think outside the constraints of the research, I think you'll probably see stronger results in it. Well, we're not done yet, but I know you would.
That's great to hear, because, you know, it's you always end up in these situations where it's like, yeah, it worked in the lab, but then when you pull it out, it doesn't work at all. But it seems like now that that loosening is actually just allowing you to make it even stronger when we don't have to, you know, isolate and control every little tiny variable that we were before. Right. So
yeah,
that's great to hear. So I was thinking, as you were describing that, Bart, conceptually, is it almost seem like, I don't know, is it like keeping the dog on their toes or on their paws, I guess, if you will, in terms of always mixing that up so that they kind of always got to be.
Yeah. And I mean, I think we'll, you know, and Jennifer, we'll discuss, you know, some things that we did to take, you know, take in consideration with this. But yeah, from my perspective, is it's the mindset of, you know, you have a high quality dog. You know, our dogs are purpose bred. They're, you know, we breed them to work. We develop them to work. And a dog's nature, you know, coming from, you know, their ancestors, is to be efficient, right?
Mm-hmm.
And to be efficient is, you know, lock into something that is the easiest to get you rewarded. If you make mistakes, then I'm going to find something that I can guarantee 100% of the time I'm right. So sequentially training, like we traditionally do, reaching the, you know, 100% proficiency, that is more reinforcement and more trials, to the point that that dog is so specific, mm-hmm. right? And then we're always worried about contamination, you know, dogs picking up on things that are not the explosive odor. So we're using pristine samples, correct? Because we want to present pure odor. And with that much reinforcement history with it, I have seen this and experienced it with really high quality dogs and litters, that they can even be so specific to, say, smokeless powder, that they'll only find one smokeless powder that is from the certain batch and lot number from the factory.
Yeah.
You know?
We even saw that in some of the experiment, is even just changing out the vial a little bit would then cause some generalization of a decrement.
Exactly.
This is used versus unused smokeless powder.
So, yes. You
know, keeping that mindset, not enough reinforcement. Reinforcement to generally know the odor, right? Generally know the odor. And then that odor can change as we layer things, right? So not only are they not too specific, but they are always thinking there could be another type of odor. And probably, you know, a fringe benefit of this, or, you know, unexpected benefit, is a search technique, right?
Mm-hmm.
So not only, so if I start with certain odors, and this dog's foundation is easier odors, because I'm not going to start with the hardest odors if I'm sequentially training a green dog.
Yep.
Then their whole foundation and hundreds of reinforcement of learning odor is working in a way that is not systematically and methodically and interrogating in a way that they can detect harder odors. Now, when I get to a harder odors, I'm not teaching a dog an odor. Now I'm fighting the procedure and the way it's learned to operate in the task that's working against it. So
yeah,
there's a lot of benefits from that. That's not just maybe generalization.
Yeah, we saw some of that kind of almost in the lab too, right? Is when you get some of the smokeless powders, a dog can just kind of pick its head up and just, it's there. Like,
yeah.
That's not a problem, yeah. But that's not going to work for TNT, man. You know, you need a different search technique for that to work.
Yeah, I mean, you go from smokeless powder. Say I did this a long time ago when I didn't know what I was doing. Start with C4, and then my next one, we're going to TNT. It took a long time for these dogs to get to where I could get them to work to detect them.
Yep. So have you taken this intermix out from boxes to, like, searches yet?
Yeah. Yes. I mean, Jennifer can explain the setup we did, because that was one of our things was, we also know, you know, generalization is an issue, but also we're always fighting when sequential training is transfer of context.
Mm-hmm.
We're going from boxes, but our boxes are just to learn the odor so we can have them located in an operational environment. And as I said before, traditionally you would do an intermediate step, right? And depending on the quality of dog litter, you may have another intermediate step. And mm-hmm. then multiple venues before you lay another odor. So Jennifer, she can explain, because, you know, she designed how we mocked up that transfer of context, where we still did have some control to clearly see the results.
Well, when we did this experiment outside of the generalization boxes, we did use an odor lineup for our traditional imprinting. But then when we took it outside, our context changed. We had a couple of different setups because we were using some lower volatility odors. So we had to be be careful with things like that, also distractors. And so we tried a few different setups before we got to one that we liked, but we used some cinder blocks. We did kind of a couple different versions of some odor walls that we liked. And so we changed it up kind of with the mix of the dogs that we used.
And it seemed to work across those different contexts pretty well.
It did. I mean, there was a learning curve at first with the very first setup we did with this odor wall specifically. The odor was kind of traveling up the wall through seams that we weren't anticipating. So the dogs weren't alerting right where the odor hole was. They were kind of alerting on the sides and on the seams. So we changed things up a little bit so it wouldn't be quite so frustrating for them. But it was good.
So in short, we got recognition of odor.
Right.
That was an issue. So we saw our transfer of context. So when we redesigned it, that in our lineup or wall, that when the dog hit odor and was showing us where source was where actual source was, mm-hmm. and not drifting down to now I've got a dog responding and I know that's change of behavior on odor and responding to odor, but there happens to be a distractor. Mm-hmm. Or a novel thing, because we need to rotate that in to be sure in that general vicinity. So through the development of it, we had the dogs work a lineup that they had never seen before. Like, they've only seen boxes, never worked cinder blocks, never worked paint cans holding the odor, right? Mm-hmm. In an area they had never worked before outside of the imprinting area. And these dogs had only been in one room doing imprinting. So,
right.
Off the truck, completely different area, completely different setup. And I would say, Jennifer, do you want to explain what odors we used and the variants of them? I think you already said the base, the odors, but what type of variants we used to probe. Not only, we got the transfer of context, that they hit the odors that they had learned, right?
Mm-hmm.
But
right.
Then we wanted to look at generalization. Now we knew they transfer context.
Right. So our base odors, we had a single-based smokeless powder, double-based smokeless powder, AN, and also TNT. So the variants that we used were, you know, one from each of those classes. Mm-hmm. And then what we also did was take a variant, I believe we used smokeless powder, and we changed the packaging. So all of our odors during imprinting were packaged in a cotton bag. And then when we exposed them to a variant of that odor, in their contextual change session, we packaged them differently. So we had it in an anti-static container for one. I believe we had one mixed with a piece of metal pipe. So just kind of giving them the same odor, but removing the packaging that they were imprinted with and putting it with something else and seeing if they would respond. And we had a really good success rate with that.
Yeah. Well, that's fantastic.
And for one odor in particular, the TNT, as we found in the gin boxes when we were doing the study, that we had some contamination, right?
Right.
We had some plasticizer contamination from handling use of it in the past that would probably be present and realistically in everyone's the TNT they're using. And we presented that TNT, which we knew was contaminated. And as you said before, you had saw in the study that, you know, that a contaminant may prevent the generalization. Well, this explosive was, the TNT was housed in a different barrier material. Like you said, they had only seen all of our explosives in one type of barrier material. On top of that, it was contaminated. And we saw, correct me if I'm wrong, Jennifer, no dog question that.
Correct.
We saw no dog question anything, to my knowledge, except for the cast TNT.
Yes, and I believe we had one single-based smokeless powder that a couple of the dogs, maybe it was just one dog, that bypassed, but the rest of them showed at least a change of behavior, if not an independent trained thought response.
Yeah.
Yeah, the dogs did really well overall with the variants.
And the cast TNT would be expected. I mean, I think everybody's experience and maybe research would show that, you know, going from flake to a cast TNT material, you know, is usually explicitly trained and treated as a completely different odor. But we did have dogs hit. We did have one dog hit every odor.
Yeah.
Now we could say that we had novel distractors. We controlled for that when we did the shift. She also did hit, I believe, one novel loud chemical odor. So
yeah, it was either the Sharpie or the Rust-Oleum, one of the two.
And we broke the cast material down too. We even had a version of it that was ground instead of just the pure cast material as you would see it naturally.
Right.
So that shocked me. And even with the cast material, I believe we did see a lot of the dogs or some of the dogs have a change to it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you had asked me through all of my experience of going from flake TNT to cast TNT, you wouldn't even get a change in their first experience.
Yeah, I think our control groups in the gen boxes were like 10% response rate to the to those.
So.
Yeah. So definitely a big difference there. Well, that's cool. If you're going to apply this, you know, if other people listening were going to apply, are there any considerations that, you know, did flag up that you would say this is what you need to think about if you're going to try and apply this in your own situation?
I think it would definitely be beneficial to do some task training, some foundational task training with the dogs so they understand how to work a box lineup.
Mm-hmm.
Definitely that. Training with relevant distractors would definitely be another factor to keep in mind. Items used in the packaging and storing of your training aids, gloves, novel odors the dog might encounter in an operational environment. Those are all going to be good distractors to use in your training early on.
Yeah, that's a fair point, because if you're, you know, if you've got something that's going to help you with generalization, if you're not careful in that imprinting to get your right distractors in there, and like yeah. you never use handling material or you never use any of the gloves as distractors, you might actually be going too far, you know, in that direction. So it might be quite important to consider having those right distractors from the get-go.
Right.
Yeah. And one thing that on top of, you know, having the component distractors and contamination, how it's handled, barrier material. As we saw firsthand, Nathan, we went, you know, back and forth on this and figuring it out, which made sense, is thinking about the strengths of the target odors and how relevant are the distractors, if we call them distractors, when it comes to signal strength,
mm-hmm.
right? So if you were working with C4, you know, your relevant distractors are going to be things that are more loud, you know.
Yep.
Chemical, plastic things, things of that nature. Now, when you get down to TNT, and you need to have your lineup, and basically Jennifer developed the protocol into how the lineup was to cover all those for, say, those four. So we had a blank box, and we had things that, you know, maybe the barrier material was nothing, which is, yeah, it's a barrier component, but it's a subtle different odor, and then loud odors. So when you get to the AN and TNT, you're most likely and most relevant distractor would be the box with a subtle odor to it, maybe the barrier material.
Mm-hmm.
And then the most relevant would be the blank, right?
The signal strength of the distractors is one thing. On top of them being components and contamination of barrier materials and glove, the strength of which the odors you're training should be taken in consideration. So if you have loud odors, you need to have relevant loud odors as distractors. And then when you get to the lower odors, lower strength odors, like AN and TNT, your blank box or your box holding something like just a barrier material like cotton bags, the subtle ones are the most relevant. Train, your dogs are not responding to a disparity in signal strengths. They are responding to the odor. So no matter if we're doing intermix, we need to ensure they're learning the odors and not difference in signal strength. So when we go and test this, we know they understand the concept we're trying to put into them by intermix and the odor, so we can test it.
Yep, and we saw that in the research trials too. I mean, some of the hardest ones were blank, blank, TNT, or blank,
yes.
TNT, blank, or those are some, blank, blank, blank was actually the hardest, yeah.
Yep.
So, yeah. That's a good point. All right, so then in terms of, you know, for explosives and traditional explosives training, in your experience, what benefits do you think the intermix training seems to have over some of the other methods, particularly the sequential that you've used previously?
Well, the one thing you hit on from my perspective from explosives in the gin boxes, and as you know, we laugh, is like we may see better results, you know, outside the lab. You talked about sniff rate, right? You might not have got a full-on train response, but given the sensor that we use in the laser beam and break and the break time, we calculate that they were interested in it. They recognized some form of similarity. And that's what I call in my world a change of behavior, right? So when in traditionally sequential training, I need to be able to know, can they hit this type of TNT? Can they hit this form of an RDX explosive or a different type of C4, tag it, untag, you know, those type things. And when I get place those out in the field, right, when I get there, the dog should have a strong enough behavior or give a trained final response. If it does not, I need to change a behavior to assist them, right? A strong change. But sometimes what happens is in the sequential type training is that they're so specific that when you get there, you don't have a change of behavior. So yeah. Now you may have to go back and train for that specific odor, just like it's a different one. Okay, well, that takes a lot of time. And how many variants of that odor could be? It'd be a lot, right? Or how many departments, how many have access to these type of variants that could be threats that their dogs need to have experience with? They only have a day out of a year or quarterly, right? Mm-hmm. So when they get there and they don't have a change, they're probably bringing that dog back to it, right? And yeah. They're going to assist it. What are they assisting it to? Mm-hmm. The environmental contamination that the dog could pick up from setup of the scenario, disturbance, right? So now we've got a dog that may not be responding to explosive odor. We have a dog that we are now training to detect disturbances in a training scenario that will not be there in an operational setting. But if I come from this type of training and I get a change of behavior based on the way that we did it with these variants, I can't assist the dog and guarantee that dog is bridging the gap. And now he goes, oh, now this scent picture can be this much different. But I may not have had that ability to do it without this style of training. And if I didn't, I caused more problems if I assist the dog and know that it's probably not odor, right? Mm-hmm. Even from a handler cue perspective, like we want these dogs to be independent. There's no change of behavior. I don't have access to this. I've got to get experience with it in this eighth placement. I'm bringing it back, cueing the dog, telling, hey, check here, and just listen to me and sit. Okay, now all this training of being independent, operationally relevant, I'm backtracking on. And I'm probably not teaching what I think I'm teaching to the dog and making the dog less operationally relevant.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point that maybe we hadn't really thought through from the lab side completely is because, you know, even though we're getting that increased change of behavior and we're thinking, well, but it's not giving us that full 4-second nose hold. But if you're thinking of it from a training perspective, that's got to be massively different what it looks like in terms of difficulty of training when it comes to a dog that's going to turn their head, hold their nose for 2 seconds or 2.5 seconds versus a dog that walks it like this has nothing related to what they're doing whatsoever. That, you know, one dog you can shape in a matter of minutes and the other dog, you're back to square one, Clee.
Yes, and from an operational standpoint, not just training for an operational standpoint, if you're searching with a dog, and most people would tell you this, trained operationally, yeah, trained final response, great. But if I've waited for that to happen, I've messed up, right? Most of the time, I already know where the target is. I've read my dog's behavior, right? Mm-hmm. So what you would see with it, maybe the odor is different, but the dog recognizes it based on your tree imprinting technique. And you see some generalization, but the dog gets to source, works odor, gets to source and say, there's some things different here. There may be some things missing. There may be some things added on that's different in this variant. Mm-hmm. And he may not give a final response. He may show a super strong change of behavior. And he goes, yeah, that's not exactly right. And leaves. But what would happen in operationally is I'd see that super strong change of behavior and say, that is my dog's behavior and odor, right? Mm-hmm. And it's right there. We're already out of there. That's somebody else's problem at that point, you know?
Yeah, exactly.
That's a fine. That's what real world fines look like. We train for the worst case scenario so that they give a passive operant response to be safe in the presence of an explosive. But in reality, I would never want to get to that point.
Well, that's a good point. That's definitely highlights the importance of bringing that trainer perspective in on some of these paradigms as well. And then, so we talked a lot about explosives. Do you think there's applications of this outside of explosives?
Absolutely. For me personally, outside of the work that I do at Auburn, I train human remains detection dogs. And with this type of detection training, the dog's ability to generalize is very important. So I use an intermixed method with my own working dogs when I do their initial imprinting and have had a great deal of success. I can imprint a sample of tissue, for example, and then continue to layer a target odors with different levels of decomposition. So I'm able to imprint a broad spectrum of odors in a short period of time, and then can use those odors within the same training area. And the dog understands that there are multiple targets that they can locate.
And I'll add to that, and my experience with the, you know, in some of the projects that I get to do here in conservation work, you know, in novel pilot studies with, say, for example, pythons. Like, we got asked to do that years ago. We have no idea whether a dog can smell a python. What odor that would they be detecting? And what I wanted to not find native snakes in the areas in South Florida, the Everglades, right? Some of them are venomous, and there's lots of other non-venomous species. So, but I needed them to generalize because we wanted to find hatchlings, neonate hatchlings, maybe just hatched, never ate before. Maybe that's a factor. We wanted to find juveniles of sex, male, female. We wanted to find mature individuals of male and female. And then there's a seasonality effect of when they go into breeding season, where the males track down the females and they have mating balls. So something's changing there scent-wise for them to find them. And how do we do that? And then when you're working with a highly regulated invasive species, or say maybe you have an endangered species, training aids are at a premium, right? Especially mm-hmm. when you need a training aid outside the area that they don't have them, so they don't want you to take them there.
Yeah.
So what we did was broke down age, you know, juvenile, mature, breeding age, male, female, and then we broke it down to the area on that individual. We collected samples odors, you know, dorsal, ventral, whole body, head, and even snakes that were in blue phase, so they're about to shed, things of that nature. And I've got six snakes, and I've got to use these snakes to train the dog so that I can transition to the field, right?
Mm-hmm.
Right? And I've got to use that to train to get there to South Florida. And if I train too much with those individuals, I'm least likely to bridge that gap to the odor of the operationally relevant target, right? The mm-hmm. more I train. So how do I slow play it? And how do I ensure I get generalization, but not over generalization? I did intermix then. I didn't know that's what it was. Mm-hmm. But it's just breaking it down. How do we get generalization, not generalization? And it worked. You know, we found everything other than a hatchling. But we did test hatchling in plot studies, and they did hit hatchlings. I'm pretty convinced that I never came across hatchlings. So yes, there is a benefit from being able to capture not just males, not just individuals within a species, but to generalize in an area that have similar species of snakes or other species, but not your non-target species. So the generalization range to maximize the dog's potential to find the targets or any individual in the target, but not to overgeneralize and get false response.
That's cool. I mean, same problem, different target, in other complex ways.
Mm-hmm.
Thank you guys very much. I mean, I think that covers a lot of that project. Did you have fun? That was the most important
thing. Oh, yeah.
It's been a lot of fun.
Well, good. Well, thank you guys so much for joining us. And thank you for giving us a rundown of this project, and more details to come out in print and publication as it comes through. But thank you for your time and helping explain this and giving us the updates on how this is looking, transitioning to operational activity. And glad to hear it's like only getting better and not worse. So that's I feel like that's not always the outcome of research. So that's great to hear.
Thank you, Nathan.
Thank you.
Thank you, guys. Thank you.